Now, before I begin, I want to ask a question. I don't want people raising your hands. I mean, mainly because I don't think I want to embarrass anybody. But Peter Warshall, when I first got turned on him in the late 70s, I read this essay and he asked the question, I mean, do you know where your water comes from? Okay, where the water comes from that you drink out of your tap. Do you know where it goes when you flush your toilet? Do you know if it's raining, where the water goes from your house to the sea, by what route? And I realized, well, I didn't know that much of those. I couldn't answer all those questions, but it became interesting. Anyway, so keep that in your mind. That's kind of, that's behind it, because I want to help you think. You know, it's worth getting to know your own little water, learning those things if you don't know them already. And I'm going to tell you how learning those things for me, or at least one of them, where the water goes when it rains, has become very important to me. So this is what the ministers call a confessional sermon. That is, I'm going to tell you some about myself, but I hope in the process you might learn some about yourself. So that's the idea. For many people, the world of nature is as close as they often come to an self-conscious sense of the religious. And there's nothing in nature quite so calming and relaxing as sitting at the water's edge. So it's not surprising to find in water one of the great universally recognized symbols of renewal. Water imagery is found throughout the Bible, in dozens of psalms, throughout Proverbs and the prophets, and parables of Jesus and the letters of St. Paul. We read in Kings and Chronicles of the river Kidron, running through the valley between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives, beside which the Judean kings Asa and later Josiah came to their senses, leading important reform movements in the early history of our faith. In the New Testament, there's the Samaritan woman at the well who longs for and receives water to endeth her thirst. Revelation assures the faithful that the saved will all drink three draughts from the spring of the water of life. In the book of Acts, those who are baptized in water experience a rebirth in spirit. Eastern religions, too, look to water for insight. As we heard in this morning's third reading, water is a favorite symbol of Lao Tzu's for Tao, that profound and mysterious sub and meta stratum of the universe out of which everything comes to birth. For many UUs, including many here, according to the survey that you conducted of yourselves last fall, feeling close to nature and connected to its cycles is central to the sense these people have of the sacred. Landscaping, working in the garden, walking in the mountains or at the beach, these kinds of experiences are where many UUs feel closest to God. For others, and this includes a lot of our young people, there's great religious meaning drawn from ecology and efforts to support it. Plus, there's Earth Day this Friday. So with all this in mind, I've chosen this symbol of water, or watershed, as my topic. But in truth, the topic was chosen for me, as it's been part of my regular meditation practice for the last 34 years. What do I mean, meditation? I lead the congregation in various kinds of meditation and prayer here every week, and I do this and I vary it to try to demystify these practices. 40 years ago, when I was first starting out in Unitarian ministry, the very word meditation brought visions of navel-gazing yogis or strange esoteric fakirs sitting on beds of nails. Nowadays, we recognize all kinds of meditation, many quite accessible to Western minds, honed on TV and pop culture. just sitting reading fairy tales or poetry or contemplating a beautiful painting can be meditation. Reading certain kinds of philosophy can be meditation. Working in the garden, listening to music. These are kinds of meditation too. Ways to relax and get in touch with our deeper rhythms. Allowing our unconscious to bubble up and clear our heads of the never-ending thoughts and chatter, monkey mind inside. And thereby, in the process, elevating our consciousness. But what do I mean by watershed consciousness? How did this become my meditation? As a child growing up in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, I lived across the street from a huge wooded park with a lake in it. And there were other lakes upstream, creating this beautiful chain, a sylvan chain of suburban lakes. A long, dilapidated mill house and other ruins were at the far end. And to my 8 to 10-year-old way of thinking, these were the perfect venue for many adventures. I wasn't actually supposed to go over there without a buddy, and which I usually complied with. And we would play in the little streams, building dams, skipping stones, and fantasizing with makeshift boats, just playing around as youngsters all do at the water's edge. I remember also being in school at about the same time, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and learning geography, a subject I excelled at and enjoyed. I remember learning the shapes of all the states. There are many of us here, I'm sure, that I could hold up images of the various shapes of the states of the United States, and they'd be able to identify right away, oh, that's West Virginia, that's Idaho. Well, some of them are easy, and they look pretty unique, but some are pretty much the same. I think that's Kansas, but maybe it's one of the Dakotas. But still, we all know roughly what the shapes of the 50 states look like. If, on the other hand, I were to hold up an outline of the San Gabriel Coyote River watershed, which close to 3/4 of us live in, and in which we are all sitting right now, we probably get only a couple among us who would know what they were looking at. Well, eventually I realized, not in the fourth grade, mind you, but many years later, that I'd kind of been ripped off, mind-popped, as they said, in the 60s. That learning geography in school had been restricted to learning political geography, as though God had etched the American state boundaries on creation's eighth day. What I realized essentially was that it's not a very sensitive awareness to remember what West Virginia looks like, but it's an extremely sensitive awareness to know what one's own little watershed looks like. Nevertheless, it took a long time before I came back to that. What brought it home to me, which is often the case in all our lives with these transformational insights, what brought that to me was a deep personal crisis, my divorce from my first wife in 1982. That year, 82, was an extremely tough one for me. Things that had been very dear were falling apart before my eyes. I did not want to get divorced, but the facts were there. And after my initial hardened responses did nothing to heal the rift between Susan and me or my personal sense of loss and pain, hardened but determined, I just got in my work at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley, where I was the assistant at that time. One of the things I'd been involved with that year and was helping with was I'd helped design and run this adult program, adult religious education program, which we called Oasis. We were trying to create retreats and workshops that fostered a sense of the spiritual, of deep meaning. We'd arranged for 4 such events over the course of the year, and one of them, which I'd set up much earlier, but which came about shortly after Susan and my separation, was a Zen retreat weekend. The retreat leaders were a married couple, Lou and Blanche Hartman. both of whom were Zen monks. They had led fascinating lives, actually, before embracing Buddhism. Lu as a newscaster and Blanche as a University of California scientist. Eventually, they quit their day jobs and became monks at the San Francisco Zen Center. Indeed, Lu went on to become the head monk of their monastery at Tassajara in Monterey, Cana. Now, the Harmans were in their 60s and very cool people. Plus, their heads were shaved. This was long before Sinead O'Connor, and seeing a woman with a shaved head was shocking to me. But by any standard, both Blanche and Lu were very beautiful people. This Oasis weekend was a long, it was a three-day weekend. And we spent many hours in long meditation and work. The work was oiling all the pews and the woodwork in the UC, in the First Unitarian Church of Berkeley sanctuary. These were beautiful redwood furnishings that had been brought from the church's original building, old and smoothly worn, but dried out and in need of both oil and elbow grease. We also oiled the altar, scraping off years of candle wax and the pulpit and the lectern, too. It was hard and painstaking. Each day began at 4:30, sitting zazen for 2 hours, and then eating breakfast, all silently. Then we'd go to work. Meanwhile, as the weekend continued, I did feel this growing trust and feeling of relationship building with Lu Hartman, and I really liked that. We had a brief talk as I helped him prepare breakfast Sunday morning that had meant a lot to me. Soon, however, the weekend was over, and I was back in the world of everyday affairs and forgot all about meditation. In April, my just-turned 2-year-old daughter and I moved from the dwelling in which she'd been born and that we shared with her mom into a little house, a cottage, really, at the foot of the Berkeley Hills as they flatten out toward the bay. And running through the front yard was a little stream, Quail Creek, or Cordonesis, as it's called in Spanish. How I got the place is kind of interesting. I've been living on a houseboat for almost 3 years, over 3 years, in the Berkeley Marina. Indeed, my daughter Meredith was born on the boat. But when her mom and I separated, we agreed to both move off. I'd fix it up some, which I did, and Susan would negotiate the sale. Meanwhile, a member of the congregation whom I'd been visiting for a year and a half died. Suddenly, out of the blue, her heir calls me from Colorado and offers me a place to live in his mother's house for a very modest rent in exchange for disposing of some of her possessions plus some minor repairs and yard work. So it all worked out, a silver lining during a very cloudy, tough period. Now it happened that one day, not long after my daughter and I had moved in, quite by coincidence, I was standing in the front yard. And who should walk by but this Tassajara Monastery fellow, Lu Hartman? This is amazing because he lived and worked in Monterey County, 100 miles away. And I was in an obscure, non-commercial, residential corner of Berkeley, not a main street at all, when suddenly I looked up and saw this bald man walking along in long black robes. My God, I thought, I know that guy. That's Lu Hartman, who led our Oasis retreat at church. It was uncanny. Anyway, I immediately greeted him and invited him to sit down with me on a little bench there next to the creek in my front yard, which he did. I wanted so much to reach out to him. We had spoken a little that Sunday morning, 2 months earlier, but after a few minutes, he had said in a kindly but very firm manner, "We're supposed to be quiet while we're making this food." Intimidated, I immediately shut up. But now was my chance, and I jumped at the coincidence. I told him about my own emotional pain and sense of estrangement from not only from my spouse, but even from myself. Indeed, and from God, from the world of the spirit, from the world of nature, the whole basic rhythm. I was out of joint. Lou then shared with me some of his struggles, too, which put mine in perspective. Then after sitting quietly for some time, side by side, and listening to the gurgling stream, he offhandedly remarked, "This brook runs from the hills to the bay. For convenience, we give it a name, Cordonesis. But really, it's always changing, always in flux, always in dynamic interrelationship with everything around it and within it." We sat for another 8 to 10 minutes before saying goodbye and parting. Well, just like the river, so each person, though given a permanent name, is always changing, and always in subtle biological, chemical, and social interrelationship with everything else. For convenience, we take permanent names, but the truth is we are always in total transformation. Meditation is the art and practice of breaking through our hard-headed, never-ending thoughts and will and coming to experience or feel a sense of deep connection and relationship with the whole of creation about us and our deepest selves within. It's getting that hit of the really real and feeling connected again, relinked, remembered to the whole. Now, the word meditation comes from the Latin root meditare, meaning to muse, reflect upon, or care. It's not really all that exotic, leisurely turning over an image or an idea and allowing the unconscious to bubble up and infuse one's mind. As a youngster, as I have mentioned, I used to spend countless hours playing in the little stream across the street from my house. It calmed me down. Many of you have had similar experiences, I'm sure, or observed others doing it. Water play, maintained the developmental psychologist, is the greatest thing for children. My landscape architect sister once commented to me how healing and comforting water is, how it's forever graceful and always fits in, the perfect addition. "A fountain does wonders," Janine explained. "If you only have so much money, put in a fountain." So it came to me, sitting there, creekside, Lou Hartman had walked off to practice his Zen somewhere else, "Your meditation, Steve, is this creek. Get to know it. From the headwaters to the sea." It was not the Amazon, so "from the headwaters to the sea" was actually management. "The road to heaven leads through hell," wrote Dante, or as Thoreau put it, "I cannot come nearer to God and heaven than I live to Walden, even." The only way for me or anybody to be healed, to become at one with the source of our being, is through the personal and the concrete. "Then I live to Walden even." As Thoreau writes elsewhere in Walden, expressing this emergence of the eternal through the concrete, "Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. I drink of it. But while I drink, I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper, fish in the sky, whose bottom is pebbly with stars." And so I did. Follow back any coincidence far enough, say the Hindus, and you find an inevitability. The series of coincidences that, one, got me involved with the Oasis retreat, and then, two, it put me in this little cottage, followed by, three, a chance meeting with Lou Hartman, and yet the inevitability that I was to follow out, get to know this creek, this Cordonesis watershed, that my way to be healed, to cross the divide in myself and in my relations with Susan and with the world, in other words, to reach my own inner watershed and start coming back down to earth on the other side of the divide, was to get to know my own little watershed running, as it happened, right through my front yard. And so I trudged from the top of the Berkeley Hills. There are actually four spring-fed tributaries that come together all the way to the Pacific. It's only about the whole length, maybe 6 miles, because it wandered. Interestingly, of all the creeks in Berkeley, and there are 10, Cordonesis is the only one that was never culverted, or as the engineers put it, remains unimproved. It runs open and unimpeded from the headwaters to the bay. In many places, its course divided people's properties. Also, it curved through three city parks, the town Rose Garden, where I had officiated at several weddings, two schoolyards behind the Westbury Library, skirted the edge of St. Mary's College High School, and here and there, like at my house, went through someone's yard. Over a period of about 6 weeks, I trudged, come what may, along almost every inch of the Cordonesis course, from its source to the sea, where thoroughbred horses at the Albany racetrack actually grazed alongside of it and drank. A free-flowing, unpolluted stream running right through the middle of town. I've continued meditating in this way ever since. Everywhere I've lived, it's become one of my spiritual practices. Here in Orange County, that's meant getting to know Fullerton Creek, a picture of which, taken a half mile from here 10 days ago, graces our order of service. Like Brea Creek to the north, I guess that would be there, and Carbon to the south, Fullerton drains an area to the south and west of the Fuente and the Tiente, and then the Fuente hills about there, and Coyote and the Chino hills up there, and then it flows. This water flows kind of southwest, and then due west across all of Fulton, all three of these creeks, really, and all of Buena Park before merging with the Coyote and San Gabriel Rivers and thence to the sea, marking the L.A.-Orange County line as it goes. From north of Lampert Road and east of California Route 57, I've walked along much of the Fullerton's course. It runs through the Birch Hills Golf Course and Craig Regional Park. Mary Rhodes and I enjoyed libations on her porch overlooking a section. It disappears underground in many places, and sadly, once it's past Acacia Park, that is, after it leaves, it crosses right here, Acacia. It disappears underground. And in many places, underground, it pops up in there. But sadly, after Acacia Park, it's almost entirely channeled in these concrete troughs. At this point, some of the maps refer to it not as a creek, brook, or even as a wash, but generically as flood control channel. But once it merges with the Coyote, it begins to progressively go more native as it approaches the sea. I feel much closer to this community by virtue of these walks and much more appreciative of its natural landscape. Now, walking like this engages the whole person. The Greek philosophers, the peripatetic school, they would walk when they would philosophize. It engages all the senses. It's tantric, really, somatic, bodily, involving one's whole central nervous system, not just their left lobe. And it cannot be a head trip. It's yoga, and it's healing. The Watershed Way, writes Peter Warshall, as read by Barbara, means looking at landscape, looking at water as it exists in landscapes, learning to think and feel like water. And Lao Tzu, there is nothing weaker than water, but none is superior to it for overcoming the heart, for which there is no substitute. That weakness overcomes strength, and gentleness overcomes rigidity, no one does not know. think, and feel like water. Drawn effortlessly by gravity, water is never pushed by anything from the outside. It humbly and always seeks the lowest point, the middle ground. It's even, equal. Always it finds the middle course between the hard, unyielding mountains on either side. Whatever is stringing you out or keeping you feeling unconnected, the watercourse way can help you find the middle ground. Between the extremes of left wing and right wing, Shiite and Sunni, husband and wife. Always the watershed way steers the middle course between extremes on every side. And the river keeps moving. You can't step in the same river twice. Who does not know that? Of course, we all want to. We all long for the good old days and to have things just the way they used to be, wrapped up and held tightly in our mother's loving arms. Alas, we cannot do that. It does not work, and it will not heal us. You can't go home again, wrote the novelist Thomas Wolfe. You can go straight ahead and discover your way home that-a-way, but never by going back. Here's my main point. The watershed way, and when I say that, what I mean is just watching, take the term from Alan Watts, but it's just being next to water and watching, absorbing. That's how does water, looking at water as a symbol for how to conduct and live one's life. And if you do this as a regular meditation, it becomes a way of seeing. My main point, this watershed way of seeking the middle ground and keeping moving is what we have to do in all these situations of loss, grief, and bereavement. It's not only what we have to do, it's all we really can do. And it works. It heals. It connects. Connects us with our deeper selves, with others, with the earth, and with one's the very people we know and love, even if we're estranged from them. And through all of this, with the vital, it connects us with the vital energy, the incredible Tao, the mind of God, if you will, transcendent and yet immanent, the Atman, that is Brahma, the immaculate heart. I cannot come nearer to heaven than I live to Walden even. I am its stony shore. And the breeze that passes o'er. In the hollow of my hand are its waters and its sands, and its deepest resort lies high in my thought. In 100 different ways, the psychiatrist C.G. Jung repeatedly says that the universe and the psyche are of one piece, viewed in one case looking out and viewed the other case looking internally. The universe and the psyche. It's as though our central nervous system runs right through the cosmic umbilicus. Or again, as Walden writes, Thoreau writes of Walden, I am its stony shore. Coming to think and feel like water connects us with the larger flow of life. Larger than each one of us and yet flowing collectively through all of our souls, as we all sang in our opening hymn only moments ago. And it will always come, this connection, this renewal with meditation, this renewed sense of connection, of atonement, of at-one-ment with life. Whether it's sitting in a lotus position doing yoga, walking along the river like I do, or, for instance, working with stone, as was true for Jung himself, the psychiatrist writes in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, about how, when he was 45 years old, he found himself at the end of his rope. Despite a successful and lucrative practice, he had made a serious break with Sigmund Freud, and then he started publishing books on alchemy, at which point the scientific community had all but completely repudiated him. He began to feel as though and wonder whether or not he was going psychotic. Maybe they were right. He had other problems, too, and he did not know where to turn. Isolated and alone, he was literally at his wit's end. And in desperation, he said to himself, I'll do the very next thing that comes into my mind. And what bubbled up was the memory that as a little boy, he loved playing with pebbles. He'd made little forts and enclosures and so on. And so he said, okay, I'll do it again. And he began at once to play with rocks and pebbles, just as he had as a little boy. At lunchtime, he'd leave his office, go outside, kneel down on the ground, and play. He built little houses, a fortress, and then an enclosure. And he kept at it. He built a whole village. Next, he began designing the indoors of each little building, including a room in which he built a little altar. He continued this practice for weeks and months. As time went on, he started working with stone, carving it, and so on, until, wouldn't you know it, it became his meditation for the rest of his life. He began carving symbols and icons out of stone, some of them incredibly intricate and ornate. Eventually, he built by himself a retreat off his house on Lake Geneva in Switzerland and carved entirely out of stone. And he built a tower there, also out of stone, which became his centering place or place of prayer, his personal holy ground. All out of stone. And all beginning with the spontaneous, half-conscious recollection of playing as a child with pebbles. Well, whatever your meditation is, whether it's working with stone, like Carl Jung, or gardening, like many people I know, walking along streams, like I do, running, painting, listening to music, walking your dog, doing yoga, these and other forms of meditation are all ways to break through and connect us to our inner source, the wellsprings of transformation and renewal that Henry David Thoreau and others, the transcendentalists for sure, called God. For me, crossing all that divides, reaching a metaphorical inner watershed, and beginning a less anguished, gravity-assisted, back-down-to-earth path, and back down to interpersonal connectedness and happiness has come and continues to come by simply walking along the stream. Thinking and feeling like water. Following the humble middle ground, we get in touch with the heart of what is really going on within and simultaneously all around us. The immanent transcendent stream of life flowing always through our individual hearts and minds. This is Watershed Consciousness.